From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, sentenced to life in prison when he was 17. But thanks to rulings from the U.S. Supreme Court, Detroiter John Hall is a free man after 50 years.
I had to reinvent myself. I didn't have nobody to look up to when I come to prison, a little kid, because I didn't want to be like them.
The State Department of Education throws a lifeline to 38 struggling schools in danger of being closed.
This is at least a proposal for one way to at least give them an opportunity to get the help they need.
The story of Roaring Dan Seavey, the jolly Great Lakes pirate.
Seavey's in a sailboat, you know, an old schooner, two sails, and it's just him in the wind, which to me is just very piratey.
And John U. Bacon on March Madness.
Never bet against an Izzo team when you get to March.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Detroiter John Hall was 17 when he was sent to prison for life without parole. Today, he's 67 and he is free.
I had to reinvent myself. I didn't have nobody to look up to when I come to prison, a little kid, because I didn't want to be like them.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, what is freedom like after 50 years in prison? But first, the Michigan Department of Education is offering a lifeline for those 38 schools in danger of being closed for failing performance. The reprieve is in the form of a letter from Michigan Superintendent Brian Whiston to the 8 school districts with schools on that list. Erin Einhorn reports for Chalkbeat Detroit, focusing on education issues. She's with us via Skype. Erin, what is Superintendent Whiston's offer?
For the most part, it's a reprieve. Before, it was, you know, we're going to close you down unless, you know, we believe that there's hardship for students. And it was sort of the first line was going to be closure. This is saying, here's what you have to do to stay open. They're calling it the partnership model. School districts, school boards are going to remain in control of their schools. They have to put together a team of partners, which could include community groups, union leaders, parents, other people. These are the partners. We're going to identify the causes that are causing schools not to be successful and figure out what are the solutions and the, you know, research-based solutions. So it's about making schools better, not shutting them down.
So the districts would be the ones in the driver's seat, not the MDE.
Well, it's a partnership. So, you know, everybody's got to kind of agree. They've got to reach this agreement together. So they have to come to an agreement within 60 days. And if they can come to that agreement in 60 days, the closure will be put off at least for 18 months.
18 months. Because that's the next question is how long would they get to kind of jumpstart these schools in partnership with the MDE?
This partnership plan is going to have specific goals and targets. So the district and the schools are going to agree we're going to try to meet these targets by 18 months. And if they don't, then at least what the letter says is the, you know, they call it next level accountability, which means closure or something like that.
It seems, as you're describing it, that Superintendent Whiston's approach, this partnership, is a constructive way to solve this problem of this impending closure of these schools.
I mean, I think the local school districts certainly feel that way. I mean, there were a lot of people who wanted to see closures, who felt like these schools were lost causes and that, you know, we should get the kids out of those schools and put them somewhere else. But certainly the people who were advocating for these schools, wanting to see them improve, wanting to see them have an opportunity to improve, are definitely excited about this option.
Now, I'm just curious, is there any money involved from the state in helping these struggling schools and districts meet these goals?
The letter refers to support, you know, it refers to, you know, in conjunction, you know, it says the partners must include the local school board, must include the intermediate school district. And it says, you know, MDE would like to encourage the district to also include, you know, the Michigan Association of School Boards and school administrators. There's nothing in this letter about, hey, there's additional resources.
It does seem like what the MDE is offering is what support and know-how and maybe connecting these districts with possible helpers?
Right. What struck me in the letter is that they specifically use the phrase, you know, research-based solutions. That means they're kind of hearing from the academic community about, you know, what the best practice is, what's really going to work. They're encouraging the schools to really get to know the data, you know, to figure out why are these schools not effective? And nobody's arguing that these are good schools. These are schools that are really, really struggling and that are really, really challenging, which is how they got on that closure list in the first place. So they're trying to say to these districts, let's really understand what's not working in these schools. And keep in mind, some of these schools have been, you know, at the bottom of state rankings, not just for the last 3 years, but for, you know, 8, 9, 10 years, really schools that have been struggling for a very long time and really need help. This is at least a proposal for one way to at least give them an opportunity to get the help they need. There's nobody here saying, well, we're going to give you extra money, which I'm sure many of those schools would say that that's the help they need. But they're talking about take a different approach, figure out what's wrong, figure out what's broken, figure out how to fix it. And we'll give you 18 months to show progress. And if you can't show progress, well, that's when we'll give up on you.
There's a side, another side of these potential closures that you reported on for Chalk Beat Detroit, Aaron, and the fact that some of these schools on the Detroit closure list have gotten tens of millions of dollars worth of improvements, haven't they?
People invested in these schools because the community valued the schools. This organization called Life Remodeled, they went and talked to the community, what are the schools that we should invest in? And the community identified these schools as schools that deserved investment. So the local community was investing in these schools. The local community was counting on these schools continuing to exist. And I think a lot of the anger locally with the state was that, you know, it was this outside force. It was people in Lansing looking at test scores, looking at data that wasn't rooted in the communities where these schools exist and saying, those are bad schools, let's shut them down. But the community was having a really different perspective and saying, wait a minute, no, we've been investing in these schools. Our kids are going to these schools. You know, what do we have to do to make them better?
Chalk Beat Detroit's Aaron Einhorn, as always, thanks so much, Aaron.
Thank you.
Aaron mentioned the nonprofit group Life Remodeled, one of the groups pouring money and effort into fixing up Detroit schools. Its founder and CEO, Chris Lambert, is here with us. Now, Chris, what schools have you worked on?
We've worked at Cody High School, Osborne High School, and Denby High School.
How did you choose those schools?
Well, we choose every school and neighborhood the same way. We look for two things that we call significant need and radical hope. We're not just looking for a school only. We're also looking at the surrounding neighborhood when we identify how those factors measure up. It's not an exact science of how we choose these communities, but when it comes to significant need, we're looking for where are there high levels of blight, high levels of crime, because those two things feed off of each other. And then we're looking for where are there academic challenges that can somehow be addressed through construction projects. And when it comes to radical hope, we're looking for where is there already a foundation of sustainability in process or already laid out? Where is there a lot of potential for the sustainability of the work that we'll complete?
How much money have you spent so far?
In the last 3 years, we've invested over $15 million.
Making what kind of improvements? What's the outcome of all this work and money?
Well, we do three things. One, we remodel either a school or a community asset. Two, we repair owner-occupied homes. Then the third thing we do is we mobilize at least 10,000 volunteers over a six-day process to clean up 300 city blocks. When it comes to the schools that we've remodeled, we went to the principals and we asked them, what does your facility need? And they all created lists. The sky's the limit. They went all the way down to the last detail. And then the next thing we did was we asked them to prioritize that list of what is most important. And once we got that prioritized list, we communicated it to partners who helped make it happen. So we've done really cool projects like a medical simulation lab where firefighters actually train kids to be firefighters and they're hireable straight out of high school. We did that at Cody. They also teach EMTs and certified nursing assistants. We built a football field for a school that hadn't had a home field in seven seasons. It was a $1.2 million synthetic field. We've done less sexy projects like re-roofing Osborne High School. When it rained outside, it used to pour inside the building. We stopped all the leaks and re-roofed 70% of that 150,000 square foot building.
Some big, big changes that mean a lot for the neighborhood. Did you have any idea whatsoever that the state was considering closing these schools?
No, because we spend hours and hours of research before we ever make a decision to make an investment in a school or in a neighborhood. And so when it came to the schools in particular, I mean, we're very familiar with the fact that many schools have closed down since 2000. The landscape has changed a lot, Detroit Public Schools. And so we definitely did a lot of research to find out if those schools had any chance of closing. And, of course, we talked to Detroit Public Schools. We talked to the emergency manager who represented the state of Michigan. We communicated our plans to the state of Michigan. And we talked to many business entities that were already invested in those schools. And there were no red flags whatsoever. Mm. Everything pointed to that these were places to invest for years and years to come.
And, Chris, there are people who maintain that closing those failing schools will ultimately help the DPSCD by winnowing out the failing schools and putting resources into higher performing schools. What do you say to that?
Well, I would say that that opinion probably, in my experience, comes from people who have very little to no experience of what it means to educate children in the city of Detroit. You know, I met with somebody from the SSRO recently, and, you know, God bless them on their work, but they clearly had very little understanding of some of the challenges, because one person said in disgust that he was just so upset that DPS was allowing some students to graduate who weren't prepared academically for college. And I tried to explain to him to think of that from a little bit different angle, because you're talking about there's a lot of kids who have graduated that fit that description that he mentioned. But the challenges that many of these youth face just to get through a day, and the fact that they've completed 12 years of school, is absolutely incredible. And it's kept a lot of kids off the streets. And then on the other side, you have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kids who are going to college. They are graduating from college. So there's a mix. Yes, there's lots of room for improvement, but closing schools without a better alternative is writing off these kids. It's writing off the neighborhoods. It will lead to increased criminal activity, and it's a very poor plan.
Chris Lambert, founder, CEO of Life Remodeled, having spent some $15 million over 3 years making improvements at Osborne, Cody, and Denby High Schools. Thanks so much for speaking with us, Chris.
You got it. Thank you.
Coming up on The Next Idea, employment for all Americans is ideal, but Jeff DeGraff believes protectionist trade policies aren't the way to do it. And then move over Johnny Depp. Roaring Dan Seavey is Michigan's own pirate legend. You'll learn more in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. And it's time for our weekly check-in with Michigan Radio sports commentator John Ubakin. And Red Wings coach Jeff Blashill was quoted this week, and here's his quote: "I believe the Wings will make the playoffs because of Henrik Zetterberg." Your thoughts?
Even his boss, Ken Holland, does not believe that.
based on what we're seeing with the trades.
The fire sale, basically, yeah. If you can't make the playoffs, as we said about the Tigers, mm-hmm. of course, you recall in September. If you're not going to make the playoffs, make that decision, and you start trading off players who might be gone anyway in the summer, get some value back for them while you can, and reload for the future. You get draft picks, you get money, you get clearance under the ceiling cap, all these things. That's what they're already doing. They already traded their leading scorer. So this is not a team gunning for the playoffs.
Mm-mm-mm.
So that Blashill quote is very odd. And I love Zetterberg. God bless him. But he ain't getting you in the playoffs.
It's a big wall to climb over. Well, I think about this. If your prediction comes to be, and the Red Wings are not in the playoffs for the first time in 27 years, I mean, since 1990, that is stunning. Would hitting that reset button really be all that bad a thing to do?
You know, how about this for an analogy? When I was traveling around the country a few years ago and Detroit hit bankruptcy, all the cabbies said, "Oh, Detroit's in bad shape." No, that's the best sign I saw out of Detroit in a long time. Admit where you are, get down to bedrock, start dealing with the problems you have. And I realize that a hockey team and a city are not the same things. One's a toy store, one's serious. But in some ways, admitting where you are, it might not be a bad thing.
So shake off that the clouds of glory from all those past years.
They've been dragging it out for a while, just barely making the playoffs and getting knocked out in the first round. How much value does that really have?
Now, you've been very clear this is a very weak year for the draft.
It is, and a great year for Detroit to have 11 picks coming up, maybe more, based on trades. But I will say this. Ken Holland has gotten Fedorov and Lidstrom, these great players, in like rounds 3, 6, and 9. So you never know who's going to come out of a draft. Only the first 10 or so picks are kind of guaranteed NHLers. After that, no one really knows anything.
So it's up to the scouts.
It's up to the scouts, and it's up to the coaching staff and Holland to develop them. Holland does a very smart thing, and he goes with what he calls the overripe theory, where he'll have a guy like Luke Glendening or Justin Abdicator playing for Grand Rapids, their top farm team, until everyone knows they were ready 3 months ago to play in Detroit. You know, the veterans don't resent you. The kid is not, feeling bewildered, overconfident. Holland has done a very good job with that. So with these draft picks coming in, he probably will again. That's my hunch.
Just looking past this season, which you say is pretty much toast, and looking at the needed rebuilding, how much confidence do you have, first, in Coach Blashill?
I'm not sure, because the first year and a half, 2 years, have not shown me much. And now you can't tell how much is him and how much is the roster that he's got, because he does not have a ton of great cards to play with here right now. But I've not seen an overly motivated team. I've not seen a team that plays great defense. I've not seen a team that does the kind of things that coaching can get you. So
really irregular.
Really irregular, and the jury's out, I'll say that.
Okay. And what about Ken Holland?
Ken Holland, his record in the NHL might be the best of all time, or pretty doggone close, based on the playoff streak and the four Stanley Cups and whatnot. But also, questions are being raised about him because the last 7 or 8 years have not been very good. And, you know, what is the plan going forward? Not clear. Now, there's no way he does not get a chance to do it.
Yeah.
But I will say his seat has gotten hotter than it's ever been in his career.
Over to college basketball, getting ready for the Big Ten Championships and March Madness. And both the Spartans and Wolverines had some pretty stinging losses in the last few days, especially MSU losing to Maryland in that final few seconds on Saturday. And starting with Michigan State, they're going to play the winner of Penn State, Nebraska in the Big Ten Championship.
And they will beat them.
They'll beat them. Okay, moving on.
And by the way, quickly on that one,
yeah.
Never bet against an Izzo team when you get to March. His three best players are freshmen. That's not a good formula, but they grow up quickly. They've been getting all this time, all during the season. Do not bet against the Spartans. Whatever they're seeded in the tournament, chances are they're a good pick.
And there are questions. Are Izzo and the Spartans in danger of not making the big dance?
No.
Boom.
No.
Done and done.
Done and done.
All right. Over to Michigan, helping its cause last night, beating the Cornhuskers. How do you see them doing in the Big Ten and then on to the big dance?
They play Illinois, as you know, on Thursday afternoon. They've split with Illinois, but Illinois gave them the wake-up call that they needed when Illinois said when they beat them pretty handily, Michigan is a white-collar team. That was not well-received. And when Michigan played Illinois at home, when you normally wear white collars, your white uniforms, Michigan chose to wear navy blue. There's a message in that. Since that game, they have been a different team. Derek Walton's taken over that team. They are playing their best basketball. They won 6 out of the last 8. That's a team that nobody will want to face in the tournament.
We should a hat tip or a pat on the back in sympathy for Oakland University losing against Youngstown State. That was a real shocking loss, and now that ended any chances of the NCAA.
Shocking loss and sad for the Grizzlies, of course. Yeah. Hoop fans, you're down to Michigan State. That's all you got.
Much to talk about. A lot of hoops talk
for the next month.
Michigan Radio Sports Commentator John Ubakin. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Cindy.
The best and the brightest.
Opportunities. The next idea.
We're going to find that these social and cultural factors really add a lot to economic growth.
Our nation's new president has made it pretty clear. He wants manufacturing jobs to stay in the U.S., and he wants our trade policies to put America first. The next idea is Jeff DeGraff has some surprising insights into what that would actually look like.
You may have missed it, but last summer, Walmart got into some hot water with the Federal Trade Commission for their Made in the USA campaign. According to the FTC, for a company to make that claim, all of the product's components must be manufactured and assembled in the United States. In a globally integrated supply chain, how do you determine if something is made in a country? For starters, over half the world's steel production is in China. The U.S. produces less than 5%. So chances are anything made with steel, the major component in heavy manufacturing, already fails the Made in USA test. To get around this, many companies now use the term sourced to mean products made, assembled, or grown in the USA. This is a clever marketing ploy because it tells us very little about where the jobs are being created, the real reason we value Made in the USA. That brings us to the impending shift in U.S. policy, better known as America First. When we talk about global trade, countries with well-documented protectionist practices like China, Russia, and Japan come to mind. However, according to Global Trade Alert, an independent branch for the Center for Economic Policy Research that monitors policies that affect world trade, the country with by far the most restrictive tariff and non-tariff barriers is the United States. In other words, America has been first for decades. China is the world's second largest economy. Its rise has largely been due to the massive low-wage workforce that produces about 10% of all manufactured goods in the world. This has made it a cornerstone of the global supply chain. The U.S. now only produces about 5% of all the vehicles in the world. According to the American-Made Index, the number of cars built with 75% domestic parts from the U.S. and Canada has plummeted to only 7 in 2015. This makes it highly impractical, if not impossible, to extricate U.S. manufacturing from other countries and trading blocs. This takes us to the heart of the matter. To bring manufacturing jobs back to America would likely require one of three scenarios. The first is we pay significantly higher prices for the same goods we now buy. This would most adversely affect the poorest among us, such as those on fixed incomes. And the automotive industry, a key employer in our state, would be one of the hardest hit. The second scenario is that we coerce our workforce to work for wages comparable to those in developing countries. This approach increases the number of working poor in America. The third and most likely scenario is that we automate and eliminate these jobs. Where plants once had hundreds of workers, there are now only a handful of highly skilled robotics operators. Yes, we would like to find employment and advancement opportunities for all Americans. But ironically, these proposed protectionist trade policies will leave us isolated from the high-growth markets and opportunities required to actually put America first. Let's stay in the global markets we've established over the past century and double down on our innovation capabilities. Doing it that way, we could lead the world into the 21st century and put America first the American way.
Jeff DeGraff is a professor at the University of Michigan and our partner in The Next Idea. You can find his essay at the Next Idea link. Just go to michiganradio.org.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
He was rough, he was tough, and the lawman who chased Dan Seavey declared, "Of all the jolly pirates, Seavey is the jolliest." The story of Roaring Dan Seavey is over a century old, but it's still a great yarn. Scott Atkinson wrote about the Pirate of the Great Lakes in a recent issue of Our Detroit. Scott, just who was this jolly Great Lakes pirate?
Yeah, so Dan Seavey, I believe he was actually born in New York, but he came to the Great Lakes and he was what it sounds like. He was a pirate. He was supposedly, but as we find out in the story, it's not true, the only person officially charged with piracy. So again, that was part of the legend. Well, I think legend is the right word. He seemed to live up to everything that he did, and yet he was always just this larger-than-life figure. So
how so? Like what kind of buzz surrounded this guy?
He was a fighter. He would literally sail to other cities just to accept a challenge. This didn't make it into the story, but in one of them, he supposedly actually ended a fight by killing a guy by turning a piano over on him after they had destroyed the entire bar. One of the more famous ones is he accepted a challenge from a smaller guy, who was actually a professional boxer, and that was one of the few fights he lost.
He did lose that one.
But he was just an interesting guy. I mean, he did have some legal operations, but he didn't seem to care where that legal line was drawn. What I loved about this was, you know, the Great Lakes booty was not, you know, gold and silver. It was timber or illegal venison. That was one of his things. He would go up to these lakes and poach and sell deer meat.
What a character. So what happened the night of June 11th, 1908? Because that's the night this story really began.
So there are a lot of Seavey stories. And I was looking for them. I found a great book by Richard J. Boyd that gives a extremely comprehensive, very well-researched account of his entire life. And I'm just thinking, how am I going to, you know, fit this into 3,000 words? And my favorite Seavey story was, it's really the night he becomes Michigan's mm-hmm. best-known pirate. It's unclear, but it sounds like he is working as a sailor for the crew of the Nellie Johnson under a guy named Captain McCormick. As I say in the article, he was a fierce fighter, but he was a fiercer drinker. And the way he got away with a boat was they went to a saloon in Grand Haven, and he drank them under the table until they could not stand. He was the only one that was functional, and with two of his henchmen, as I think Boyd puts it, he takes off with the Nellie Johnson, which is full of cedar posts, which is, you know, good saleable cargo, and he heads for Chicago. And from then ensues a chase all around Great Lakes, Michigan, that ends with, you know, sort of an epic climactic end in Northern Lake, Michigan, and then he's hauled back to Chicago to face the charges.
Because he couldn't sell the cargo, right?
He thought he was going to sell it
and make money.
Yeah, well, that's the great turning point. You know, he goes down there, he can't sell it, so now you've got a stolen ship full of stolen cargo. And what do you do from there?
And he had someone hard on his heels, actually a couple of men tasked with capturing him as Captain Preston Uberoth and Deputy Marshal Thomas Currier. And they were playing this, you described this really interesting cat and mouse game.
Yeah, I mean, so as a narrative nonfiction writer, like, you can't make this stuff up. And it was just pure gold. So Preston Uberoth was this guy. I mean, you can find him in old newspapers everywhere. And he was just sort of this, like, this Boy Scout. You know, there was an article written about him on the Atlantic when he was, you know, still pretty young in the Coast Guard. And he was one of a few crew who goes out, like, in this icy storm, like, rowing this boat to save this crew. When his wife died, he was, I can't remember where he was stationed, but he was somewhere far across the country. And all these newspapers pick up the story of him, you know, rushing home. Captain Uberoth rushes home to be at his wife's bedside. He was just this guy that just seems like this perfect captain, right? And then you have Captain McCormick, who wakes up one morning, presumably very hungover, and with a missing boat. And apparently it took a couple of days to get the authorities on the trail because nobody believed him.
Because he was probably so hungover.
Yeah. I mean, this is not a guy you might want to believe. And so... So he gets on the USS Tuscarora with Captain Uberoth, who at this point was stationed on Lake Michigan. And at first they didn't know where to look. And bit by bit, they just start going up the coast looking for Dan Seavey. But Seavey is a guy who's been sailing these waters since forever. So he knows, like, the inlets and the coves to go into and where to hide. And
the way you describe it, it's like a duel between technology and this Laker man with incredible Great Lakes know-how.
Well, I'm really glad you picked up on that, because I started thinking about it. Like, yeah, Seavey's in a sailboat, you know, an old schooner, two sails, and it's just him in the wind, which to me is just very piratey. Again,
This,
the more I researched, I was like, you got to be kidding me. This is just great. And then you've got Captain Uberoth, who's on the steamship, which at one point they have it steaming so hard, the paint is burning off the smokestacks.
Full speed ahead
until they finally get him.
They chased around. Finally, what happened? How was he captured?
Okay, so they're heading up the coast, and I'm not sure where it's at. McCormick gets impatient. He gets off at some port and takes a train back home where he's pretty sure Dan Seavey is. Uberoth is still on his boat heading north. They do find the boat that he stole, the Nellie Johnson, but they find it in a cove somewhere, you know, with 6 feet of water in its hold, the timber still there. So he finds a place to sink the boat and then takes off.
Gives up on the timber he can't sell just
right.
To get away.
And so they try to plan it strategically. They head out early the next morning, I believe, and there on the horizon is Dan Seavey back in his own boat, the Wanderer. This is where the details get hazy, because the newspapers at the time, I mean, they had more fun with this than I did, right? And so there, it was really tough to see where the myth ended and the truth began, or vice versa. According to some accounts, you know, Seavey's still, he's heading for one of two islands where he had, like, these secret hideouts where he was poaching, which, again, is just wonderful, and on northern Lake Michigan. And so according to some reports, they actually fired a cannon shot over the top of his boat, and that was when he finally said, okay, I give up. According to other accounts, that's just myth. I don't know. But to me, that was actually, at first, as a reporter, it's the kind of thing you run into and you're like, what's the story? I don't know. But then I realized after time, well, that is the story, because pirates are the stuff of legends.
They are.
So the fact that, was he really charged with piracy? Probably not. Did they really fire the shot? Probably not. But the fact that he became this legend, you know, because we wanted that. But
the way you end your story was stunning to me about when he was, quote, brought to justice. What, he wandered back to New Haven with a smile and a new suit?
He walked free. Yeah, and it seems really unclear. I mean, Richard J. Boyd researched that very thoroughly. He found a lot of the documents, you know, of those courts. But even to him, it was very unclear. Like, there was something happened behind closed doors where I don't think he spent a day in jail. He walked free.
But he, as far as you know, is the first to have been charged with piracy in the Great Lakes?
It doesn't look like he actually was.
Charged.
But, I mean, he became known for that,
yeah.
Right? And so, I mean, if you do some Googling around for Great Lakes pirates, more than one name pops up, but none more often than Dan Seavey.
And how did his final years spin out?
So he died in Wisconsin. Actually, my original goal for the story, because I'm not the first guy to write about him, right? You can find him, especially in a lot of the anthologies about, you know, the cutthroats of the Great Lakes and things, and he's in all of those. And so what I wanted to write about are his final days. He ends up in Wisconsin. He dies very poor, survived by at least one daughter. I think he died it was in the 50s, I think, in a nursing home. Mm-hmm. And so for this guy who lived this uproarious life, then that's the end he came to. And apparently, I think he became very religious in his final days. And so the story I really wanted to search for are the final days of Dan Seavey.
The story you tell us in Our Detroit is a rollicking good story. Why do you think we're so enchanted by pirates?
I think it's the mythology of it. Like I say in the story, you know, and it's actually like that last paragraph we talk about, my wife called me out. I'm like, you got to read this. And she's like, so he beat up people and he stole from people. And I said, well, if you want to say it that way, like, you're absolutely correct. But I think we're attached to the myth. We associate pirates, I think, with a free life, with that Johnny Depp-like character who's, you know, sailing the seas, attached to nothing, doing whatever they want, taking whatever they want. And I think that was the way Seavey really tried to live his life. Like I said, there, he had some ventures that were legal, some that weren't. It wasn't that he was doing things illegally on purpose. He simply didn't care.
There you go. Scott Atkinson wrote about Roaring Dan Seavey, the pirate of the Great Lakes, in a recent issue of Our Detroit. And once again, that quote says it all. Of all the jolly pirates, Seavey is the jolliest. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks.
John Hall became a free man after spending some 50 years in prison. Coming up next, he'll talk about what life was like through those decades. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It happened in a Detroit alley in 1967. Detroiter John Hall and an accomplice beat a man who later died of his injuries. John Hall was convicted of first-degree murder and received a mandatory sentence of life in prison without parole. He was 17 years old. His accomplice was never even arrested. But John Hall's future changed with two landmark rulings from the U.S. Supreme Court, rulings that outlawed mandatory sentences of life without parole for juveniles. And on February 2nd, at age 67, John Hall walked out of a Michigan prison with virtually nothing to help him start his new life as a free man.
90 days before I got out, they're supposed to have all the stuff that you need ready for you in the reentry program in prison. When I got out, I didn't have anything. Only thing I had was $1.37 and a Social Security card.
And no birth certificate, which means no state ID card, no driver's license.
If you don't have the birth certificate, you through.
There are over 360 of these so-called juvenile lifers in Michigan prisons today. John Hall is one of only five who've been resentenced and released since the Supreme Court rulings. What is freedom like after 50 years in prison? Accompanied by his lawyer, Valerie Newman, of the Michigan State Appellate Defender Office, John Hall sat down with me for a difficult conversation, talking about where he went wrong, what life was like through those decades in Michigan prisons, and how he hopes to keep other young people from making the mistakes that he made all those years ago. We started with what it's like to be a free man in 2017.
When I went to prison, the only cell phones I seen was on Star Trek. Beam me up, Scotty. Computer, do this. So to simplify how I view it, I always say it's science fiction because it's reality, but back then it was science fiction. And I got to learn everything all over again, like she be telling me and everybody that's helping me. I got to take baby steps, you know, and it's not been easy. Little things that everybody take for granted, you know. Swipe, give your card to the, your debit card to the storekeeper. He swipe it or whatever he do, and you got to punch it in. I had to learn that. You know, cars the same. I'm talking about on the outside, but on the inside, they little things that everybody take for granted.
That constantly you're being reminded that you've been gone all these years.
Right. Constantly. I got a good support system called my attorney, Ms. Newman. If it don't be for them, I'd be lost. I couldn't even use the phone.
Because that's all changed. There's no more rotary phones.
Right. I had a person to tell me, said, well, call me, man, call me. I said, okay, because I was too embarrassed to say I didn't know how to use a phone. He said, you gonna call me for real? I said, come here, man. Show me how to work this. You know, I built up the courage, you know, because I felt like that's a step forward. And he showed me. So, and I'm beginning to learn. I still haven't learned and mastered it.
These baby steps you're taking, at least you have control. I'm wondering, what does it feel like to let you're the one decides what you want to do and when you want to do it and who you want to see for the first time in like 50 years? How does that feel to have that power back?
It's unbelievable. Yeah, that was a good question you asked me. It's unbelievable. It's and then another reason that was a good question is because I was 3 months past my 16th birthday when I got sentenced. So I never had the chance to experience society as an adult. So that was a real good question you asked me.
What does it feel like?
It feel good. It feel real, real good. And it was something I thought I'd never feel again.
Now, I know now you're living in a homeless shelter.
Right.
Because there's nobody around. It's been all these years.
Right.
Your mother long passed.
Right.
What's that like?
Seeing everybody gone. That I left when I was 17, actually 16. Now I'm 67 years old. If I didn't have the support I had from my attorney and the support system that she surrounded me with, I wouldn't have made it. But I am taking baby steps, and I'm going to make it because I want to and because, like I say, she done surrounded me with the people that I'm comfortable with, that I don't have to feel embarrassed about nothing. And like she always tell me, if we going too fast or they going too fast, let them know. Don't hold back. But coming out when I want to after 9 o'clock, being on my own all day, not being in the environment that I was in, where it's 13 gangs in one prison. And like you said, being free ain't nothing like it.
John, tell us, what was your childhood like?
I just found out a few things a couple of days ago when I did get my birth certificate. I didn't even know my father's name. First name. I knew his last name, but I didn't know his first name. And I'm a junior. He only had one son, one child. That was me. And my mother raised me. She worked for different people 5 days a week, 7 days a week, doing domestic work. So basically the streets raised me because she was gone all the time. But she did what she could do as far as trying to raise a son and provide. But the streets really raised me. So I went to school and did all that, and all the things other kids did, you know, and got in trouble.
How old were you when you started getting in trouble?
About 13 or 14.
And there you were, as you say, 3 months past your, you know, into your a brand new 17-year-old, and you're being told life in prison, no parole. What went in your heart and your mind when you heard those
words? The reason I looked at my attorney and smiled, because it's one of the things that I talk about that I'm getting stronger and speaking about, because I usually break down when I talk about this subject. The judge told me when I got found guilty, "Mr. Hall, you have been found guilty by a jury of your peers. You are a throwaway. You are unfit for society. You are a predator. And I hereby sentence you to the State of Department of Corrections for the rest of your natural entire life." By me being so young, I knew it was bad. When I swirled around in that seat at that desk and looked at my mother's face, please.
Excuse me.
When I looked at my mother's face, I knew it was bad. Real, real bad. Took me back to the county jail. My mother came to see me. It's just, don't worry, baby. The Lord gonna be with you. Things gonna work out. And it did, cause of my attorney, Miss Valerie Newman. 50 years later, but it did. But she wasn't around to see it. And that's what hurt. So I guess that I can convey to you what that day was like for me. And then they take me to quarantine. I'm in the world's largest world prison.
Jackson.
Of Jackson. And they told him to get him out of here. He's too young to be in this prison. So they sent me to Gladiator School. The name is what caught you up in your mind is what it really was. Gladiator School. Michigan Reformatory. 4 days later, guy come up to me and say, hey, man, we was in school. He said, hey, man, that guy there just poured some water all over your papers. Your schoolwork. So I said, to myself, I said, so what? But the guy heard him. So he come down to where I was. And he say, I heard what he just told you. What you gonna do about it? So I walked up closer to him, chest to chest. And I whispered in his ear. I told him, I said, leave me alone, man. I got natural life. I said, now once we get started, ain't gonna be no holy, wait a minute, break it up, here come the police. We gonna end this. He turned and walked away and never said another word to me, and I never had no problems until later on in different prisons. But had I not did that, being in that Gladiator School, ain't no telling what line it would have. And then mom scuffling, trying to talk to the lawyers, and she ain't got no money. So I was trying to get to Jackson. Because they had the factories. Dad making $400, $500, $600 a month. Dad, I don't know what you call them places, but where they would do experiments on the human body, called Up Johns and Park Davis, where they create different drugs and stuff. And you could make money by letting them inject stuff in you and all this and all that. And, the more severe whatever they was trying to cure was, the more money you got. You seen guys with arms cut off, spangles cut off, trying to get out of prison because they got natural life. I thought about it. Because I'm already dead.
So you felt like, what have I got to lose?
I'm a little kid. Right. And finally, I got called down to the factory. Yep, the license plate factory. And I was making money.
So you had that job?
Yeah, I had a job. I was making me $300-$400 a month. Every 90 days, they'll give you a bonus, a percentage bonus. And I was paying prison lawyers to work on my case. Because I didn't have enough to get my paid attorney. They were too expensive. So I had prison attorneys. You got some of them good. I was, got guys out, so I had them. Then they closed it down. Hmm. What do I do?
Yeah.
So I started working in the kitchen.
And you took classes too, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I took a lot of classes.
Yeah.
I can't name them all.
You got an associate's degree, right?
Yes, I do.
And I understand you did a lot of religious certification?
Right, a lot.
Why did you choose those courses? What was the big picture for you doing that?
Well, I got my college degree because haven't anyone in my family ever been to college? And my mother mentioned it one day. I said, well, Mama, I'm going to be the first one to do it. And after she died, I remembered that promise. Even though she wasn't around physically, I was going to keep that promise to her. And that's what motivated me to take college. The spiritual and religious classes come from the fact that I am religious, and I felt the best way for me to tell anybody anything, you got to have authority to say it. You just can't say something to somebody and they don't, you can't show it to them. Because people believe what they see. So I started doing that, and then I started getting in thinking for a change, a new way of thinking, Cage Your Rage, Chance for Life, all these different programs, because when I look back at myself, I didn't like the John that I seen in the past.
You wanted to be a different John.
Right. I had to reinvent myself. I didn't have nobody to look up to when I come to prison, a little kid, because I didn't want to be like them. I was going with the flow, so to speak, but I didn't want to be like them. And then when I really had a chance to sit down and think, another thing that saved me, this is very important. Remember what the judge said to me? He messed me up psychologically for at least 20 years because for the rest of your natural entire life, you never forget those words. But when I stop and I'm seeing people leaving prison with life sentences, I said, wait a minute, man, that judge lied to you. You can get out. You know what I'm saying? I had heard it, but I didn't believe it till I'm seeing guys that I know personally get out. I said, wait a minute, man. You got to change.
Tomorrow on Stateside, John Hall talks to us about the crime that sent him to prison in 1967. He'll talk about the guilt that he still lives with, despite receiving forgiveness from the widow of his victim. And he tells us what his plans are with his second chance at freedom.
This is going to be inside of me for the rest of my life. And I hope that in some way that somebody will hear me and I can save a life.
That's tomorrow here on Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Bob Scon. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, Cass Adair, and Lise Mesmer. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.